The following is a recording of the Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We are located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. We are also located on the web at www.tpuuf.org. Please come visit us.
For each child that's born, a morning star rises and sings to the universe who we are. For each child that's born, a morning star rises and sings to the universe who we are. For each child that's born, a morning star rises and sings to the universe who we are. For each child that's born, a morning star rises and sings to the universe who we are. We are our grandmother's prayers, and we are our grandfather's dreamings, and we are the breath of our ancestors. We are the spirit of God. We are mothers of courage, fathers of time, daughters of dust, and the sons of great visions. We're sisters of mercy, brothers of love, lovers of life, and the builders of nations. We're seekers of truth, keepers of faith, makers of peace, and the wisdom of ages. We are our grandmother's prayers. We are our grandfather's dreamings, and we are the breath of our ancestors. We are the spirit of God. We are mothers of courage, fathers of time, daughters of dust, and the sons of great visions. We're sisters of mercy, brothers of love, lovers of life, and the builders of nations. We're seekers of truth and keepers of faith. We are makers of peace and the wisdom of ages. We are our grandmother's prayers. We are our grandfather's dreamings, and we are the breath of our ancestors. We are the spirit of God. We are our grandmother's prayers, and we are our grandfather's dreamings. We are the breath of our ancestors. We are the spirit of God. For each child that's born, a morning star rises and sings to the universe who we are. For each child that's born, a morning star rises and sings to the universe who we are. We are one.
It's a wonderful piece. Remember when we had a choir here years ago, we performed that? Anne was involved in that, I think. Right? Yeah. Good morning, everyone. And welcome to Sunday Worship with the Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, a faith community exploring new paths to kindness and to spiritual growth. I'm Jerry Lazzaro. I chair the worship committee here at the fellowship, and I extend a hearty, sincere welcome to all gathered here in our sanctuary, our spiritual home in Collegeville, PA, and to all those joining us this morning via Zoom. We extend a special welcome to anyone visiting us for the first or second time. If you're not already or not still connected with us, we urge you to fill out the visitor's card, virtual visitor's card, or one here in the sanctuary, and that way we can keep you apprised of events happening here at the fellowship. And we want you to know that whoever you are, from wherever you've come, wherever you may be on your life's journey, your spiritual journey, whatever you must in your conscience truly, responsibly believe, whatever your gender or how you express or identify it, whomever you love, whoever loves you, we welcome you to this worship service and to our faith community and to an ever-widening circle of justice, compassion, love, and peace. And a special welcome to this morning to our guest worship leader, Reverend Andrew L. Weber. sitting right behind me. Reverend Weber, Andrew, is a Unitarian Universalist minister, currently living in Newark, Delaware, with his wife and two children. He's a supply minister for area congregations such as ours. You may recall he led worship here back in January 2020, right before pretty much we suspended in-person worship due to COVID-19. He's also a CrossFit coach at the University of Delaware, a full-time parent. Quite well-rounded, he runs long distance for competitions and also for a form of meditation. Eats a plant-based diet, enjoys cooperative board games, speaks Hungarian conversationally, reads historical fiction, science fiction, and fantasy, and he listens to opera and techno. I don't know how the two of those somehow meld, but I don't know. Anyway, Andrew strives to promote a mindful and grounded life for himself, his family, and the larger community, helping people and communities live into their best selves. And he reflects on living a faith-informed life on his online blog, How to Drive Like a Minister, which is howtodrivelikeaminister.tumblr.com. And in his latest blog entry, he uses the traditional meaning of All Hallows Eve, a.k.a. Halloween, to reflect upon past family members who influenced his life. Which brings us to the theme of this morning's service, Roots and Branches, Exploring Family Systems. And Reverend Weber will begin this morning with opening words and the lighting of our chalice, the symbol of our Unitarian Universalist faith.
Thank you, Jaron. Good morning. We are here to abet creation and to witness it, to notice each other's beautiful face and complex nature, so that creation need not play to an empty house. And in the words of Murray Bowen for our chalice lighting, you have inherited a lifetime of tribulation. Everybody has inherited it. Take it over, make the most of it, and when you have decided you know the right way, do the best you can with it.
And now, as I light the peace lamp, please respond with all the people of the world.
May peace
be with us.
And with all the people of the world.
Our gathering song this morning is hymn number 8, Mother Spirit, Father Spirit. Norman Chopbeck wrote the words and music to this piece. As I'm sure you'll recall, he was the originator of Flower Communion, which we honor every year in our fellowship. And our own Christine Winchester Perry, accompanied by Isaac Strader, will perform the piece for us. Remind you that due to COVID safety protocols, we ask those in the sanctuary to refrain from singing. And we invite those joining us via Zoom to sing their hearts out. You know, say, wake the dog, wake the cat, wake the kids, wake the neighbors, whatever. Okay. And the words will appear on your screen as well as on the screen here in the sanctuary. So hymn number 8, Mother Spirit, Father Spirit.
Dreams eternal, fears infernal, haunt
This may sound like a sort of dry service family systems theory. Well, I hope I can say it's not, but wouldn't that be terrible if I came up and said, this is going to be a really dry service today? No. But I find that the application of family systems theory very, very interesting and very useful, and the application much more useful and interesting than the theory, actually, sort of with my theology, too. It's much more interesting how you apply what you believe, how you apply theory than talking about it. And so I'll be sharing stories and I'll be sharing some examples. And the first story, the first example is from, it's a reading from Understanding the Family as a System by Dr. Dan Smith from the California State University in Fresno. In his words, in recent years, the view of a family as a system has become an increasingly popular and important theoretical framework for counselors and for family therapy professionals. By definition, a family system functions because it is a unit, and every family member plays a critical, if not unique, role in the system. So as such, it's not possible for one member of the system to change without causing a ripple effect of change throughout the entire family system. In stark contrast to the system view, families have been traditionally seen as a group of individuals, of independent agents linked by their membership in a family, and any given member's behavior was not necessarily related to the other members. With such a restricted view of the family, it's entirely likely that a parent might state, "I have two children. My daughter is terrific, but my son is always in trouble. Since I raised them both the same way, there must be something dreadfully wrong with my son." Now, with the system's view, the above statement would be interpreted quite differently. Each member of the family plays a specific role. The son is literally assigned his negative role, and the daughter assumes her role with equal determination. Upon closer examination of this family, several factors could be operating that could create and sustain the system. And so one such scenario could be, mom and dad fight a great deal, and dad abuses alcohol but denies that he drinks excessively. The daughter, let's say Erica, has found that she can make things better in the household if she gets good grades and pacifies her parents when they are arguing. Being a perfect daughter is Erica's way of exerting some control over her environment. For the most part, she is able to avoid physical abuse from her father because she is so compliant. The son, Brian, is continually heartbroken over the pain felt in the family, and he's particularly affected when his mother is being hurt. He's angry, and he's discovered unconsciously that when he's acting out at school, when he's in trouble with the law, his parents fight less, and they work more like a team on problems. Brian's also sensitive to the fact that any improvement in his behavior gives mom and dad the opportunity to focus on their own problems, which causes their fighting to increase. So unless this family addresses its issues, the children will surely be affected, particularly Erica. Her adult life may be characterized by attempting to please others in order to gain approval, in order to avoid conflict. She might strive to appear to others as she thinks they want her to be, rather than who she really is. Her problems as an adult child of an alcoholic will be more intense when she attempts to develop and sustain adult intimate relationships, when she tries to juggle the relationships of her own family as a wife and a mother. Brian will suffer his own deep scars. He may continue to be angry and never trust that male-female relationship can be other than a war zone. Since he has never seen problems resolved constructively, he may be severely limited in his ability to deal with stressful situations involving important persons in his adult relationships. The family systems approach provides a solid framework for understanding how families function and how to support their change. Most importantly, the system's view de-emphasizes blaming the family's problems on a given family member. particular, a child who's acting out behavior may be a natural reaction to an unnatural set of circumstances. So with accurate identification of the process that sustains painful or stressful conditions in the family, change for the better can be both profound and permanent. Here ends our reading, and I encourage you to spend a little bit of time thinking about this example family, thinking about maybe your own families of origin. I'll give you some time of silent meditation for this personal reflection. We all have roles, we all have expectations, we all have assumptions which we bring from our families of origin into our own adult lives. What we experienced as children probably at that point seemed normal, since that was all we knew. So the way that your parents or your guardians interacted with you, whether you ate meals together, how money was shared, when or if you watched television, the kind of toys in your house, all those pieces of your lives seemed typical. That is, until you met others whose experience were different from your own. In school, maybe after high school, in romantic relationships, we start to see that our family's normal might not be normal for everyone else. The differences in families of origin becomes extremely obvious when we come to relationship with another person, when we start to share our lives with someone else. When we become intimate with another person, those parts of our family upbringing which make us who we are tend to come up, and they come up both consciously and unconsciously. So when two people start living together, they will quickly see if their toothpaste use or if their approach to cleanliness and expectations match or if they don't match. And less concrete, there could be strain or comfort in the way they act under stress, or when something unexpected, happy or sad, happens. Because you grow up with both these concrete norms and with these less tangible norms of how we act. Now, as a minister, I have the honor of walking with people as they join together in relationship, to be part of planning weddings and ceremonies of commitment. And this is precisely when people are coming together in an intimate relationship, making promises about the future of how they're going to act together. And so in addition for helping to plan the ceremony for that special day, I do some premarital counseling. And it's not to sort of assess if they'll be right, but it's to talk about communication, to talk about family history, to talk about marital expectations. And one part of my conversation is to fill out what's called a genogram, which is essentially a family tree with a whole bunch of baggage added on. So a family tree helps you record the family history through lives of family members. You can see who lived when, who was married or not married or separated and had children and how they're related. It helps you see all the stuff that goes on. But a genogram is like an x-ray for the family tree. It helps you see what goes on sort of behind the scenes. A genogram would have helped the family in this example see how the alcoholic father may be reacting to his anxiety. and thus to his children and how they were reacting to the pain that he was causing. In a practical manner, filling out a genogram means using symbols or text to add certain pieces of information. And what information you include depends on what your goal is and what you're looking at. It can be used in the medical field to look at patterns of physical illness. It can be used in the therapeutic field to look at mental illness, addiction, something else. So when I ask couples to fill out a genogram, I ask them to include their family structure, but also emotions, relationships, mental health issues. And there's a whole system of notation that goes along with this, that representing all these different aspects. So in addition to those sort of simple symbols around gender and marriage and siblings, there are notations for hostile relationships, for abuse, for friendship, for love, for violence, for abandonment, for harmony. You can imagine there's a lot of symbols. And the purpose is to see what patterns might emerge and to see, oh my gosh, there's something that happened generations ago that we've been repeating and repeating and repeating. And the purpose is to get to know oneself better. To get to know oneself better. If you're interested in genograms, if you're like, oh, that sounds really neat, or if you want to create your own to know yourself better, there's actually a really, really good introduction on Wikipedia. So if you're interested in a Wikipedia genogram, do that. Now, sometimes these patterns are obvious. Sometimes we don't have to write anything down. If I notice that lots of males in my family history have had sort of extramarital affairs, I may want to keep that in mind for my own relationships. Or if I notice that many people had problems with alcohol, I probably want to look into that more and see what that means for me. It's truly amazing when we can learn about patterns, when we can learn about ourselves by looking at this family history, by looking and seeing what patterns we are playing out. A genogram is just a tool, though. It's a tool which we can help in some aspects of life. There are many more subtle ways which we learn from our families about how we interact with the world, which are gleaned through experience or through stories. Okay, that makes sense. This makes sense. Like what I'm saying is, this isn't sort of amazing epiphany stuff. We notice the differences of expectations when we're in relationship with another, and definitely in romantic relationships. But it's also true in our congregational settings. If we're in a relationship here, which isn't a romantic, when I first was doing ministry and someone would come up to me and say, oh, I'm free to meet at 7 o'clock, I used to assume 7 a.m. I was like, oh, that's great. That's wonderful. I can meet at 7 o'clock. Now, I have since learned that I am not the norm there, and most people mean 7 p.m. when they say they can meet at 7. So when we come together in community, when we have relationships, that's when we realize that what we see as normal may be the same, it may be very different from what someone else sees as normal. It's only when we talk about that, when we know ourselves, when I know, oh, I assume morning, and that's not what other people usually assume, that we can better interact with others, that we can have a better relationship and better open relationship. And I can only speak from my experiences. Here's another story from my extended family. This is about my parents and their parents. When my parents were first married, their parents, or my grandparents, would sometimes go out to dinner together, the six of them. And my two sets of grandparents are from very, very different cultural backgrounds. My mother's parents are Pennsylvania Dutch, a very quiet, calm, reserved couple. And my father's parents were really defined by my grandmother's Italian background, very loud and lovingly pushy. Now, as it happened, whenever my grandparents went out to dinner, my dad's parents would haggle about who took the check. Because that's how they showed love. This is how you brought up. You go back and forth. You argue about the check, and you win or you lose that argument about half and half. It just works out that way. So it's never, they don't keep track, but it's like, I want to pay. No, I want to pay. No, it's okay. And it works out. You were pushy about your love. You were forceful about your care. Now, contrasted with my Pennsylvania Dutch relatives, who held the value that you say what you mean, and when someone else says what they mean, you take that and you say, okay, that's fine. And you can guess what happened. So at the end of a restaurant meal, the following would often happen. We want to pay this time. Okay. And so it ended up that my father's parents always paid for the food. And they started getting upset. They got upset because they viewed my mother's parents as unsupportive, as unwilling to pay, as cheap. And it was a classic instance of two families coming together and thinking that what they did was normal. So, well, if they wanted to pay, they would argue about it. So, well, if they wanted us to pay, they would tell us. Very different. Now, I'm not exactly sure how this issue was resolved, but I know that by the time I came into the picture, they were loving and maybe not understood, but loved each other too. And for us watching this, well, this is where we can start to see how our families of origin affect who we are and how we act. So how do I embody both this pushy love and this very passive love and care? What benefit and what detriment am I living from my ancestors? Because the really important part, I think, the really important part is to see how we act in our family, see our history, and see how we're bringing that into our lives, how we live with that history, because we have that. The question is not whether we have baggage or not. We have baggage. We all have baggage. It's a question of what you do with it, whether you know you have it, whether you can acknowledge it, and whether you can accept it, live with it, grow with it, whether you ignore it and are enslaved by it. So this is where, I mean, I get really, sort of really amazed here, because where I take the prelude that we had today to heart. If you missed it, or if you want to hear it again, it's We Are. The song is We Are. It's 1051 in our teal hymnal, and I recommend listening to Sweet Honey in the Rock. You can search that on YouTube. Sweet Honey in the Rock, We Are. It's just amazing. Or the GA Choir, which we had today. We are our grandmother's prayers. We are our grandfather's dreamings. We are the breath of our ancestors. And here, science and religion here come together, and it just blows my mind. Because it's not just what we learn from our ancestors while we interact with them. There are scientific insights which show that we are changed based on those we talk with, those we learn from, those we grow up being around, but also through our ancestors whom we may never have met. The emerging field of epigenetics, I don't know if people have heard of this, epigenetics, it's the study of cellular memory based on developmental and environmental cues. It's just amazing. It's the study of how our DNA, our very essence, is changed by stuff other than our genes. Behavioral epigenetics has started to show that traumatic experiences in our past and in our recent ancestors' past leaves molecular scars which cling to our DNA. Hold on, what? What? This is, I mean, there's stuff in my DNA. There's stuff in the very essence of my physical being from my grandparents' experiences. That's amazing. We carry with us more than just our memory, more than just our genes. We have biological markers that we're just starting to understand. Here's a piece from a June 2015 article from Discover Magazine titled, Grandma's Experiences Leave a Mark on Your Genes. I have titles that are very specific. Like silt deposited on the cogs of a finely tuned machine after the seawater of a tsunami recedes, our experiences and those of our forebears are never gone, even if they have been forgotten. They become a part of us, a molecular residue, holding fast to our genetic scaffolding. The DNA remains the same, but psychological and behavioral tendencies are inherited. You might have inherited not just your grandmother's knobby knees, but also her predisposition toward depression caused by the neglect she suffered as a newborn. Or not. If your grandmother was adopted by nurturing parents, you might be enjoying the boost she received thanks to their love and their support. The mechanisms of behavioral epigenetics underline not only deficits and weaknesses, but strengths and resiliencies too. Now that for me, that's amazing. That is just amazing. It isn't just that I watched my parents interact. It isn't just that my siblings treated me in a certain way. It isn't only the pain and the support I have received from those who have taken care of me. It's also the biology of people I have never met, of my ancestors and their experiences, which live through me, which make me who I am, define how I act. So we are defined and created mentally, emotionally, through our interactions with other people. And our emotions and our tendencies are part of our DNA through people alive and dead, present and past. Truly, truly, we are our grandmother's prayers. We are our grandfather's dreamings. We are the breath of our ancestors. And so the question remains now, so what? So what do we do? What does the family working as a system and being defined by outside past circumstances mean for our lives? It means that we have great power and we have great responsibility. For with great power comes great responsibility. We have the power to learn about ourselves through our family of origin. We have the power to know ourselves. We have the power to explore our inborn, our learned strengths and weaknesses. And then we have the responsibility to embody the best of our ancestors and to work on the difficult, to work on the not best. The religious mandate is so easy and it's so, so difficult. Know thyself. Hold on to what is good. Look to your own family. Look to your own upbringing. To those patterns, to those experiences which make you, you. Share and grow. Do the hard work of developing and learning how to be your best self, to be the best embodiment of your ancestors. For we are the breath of our ancestors. Physically, emotionally. So let us know our history and ourselves so that we might be able to better connect with each other, so that we may be better able to connect with ourselves, to love each other, to love ourselves. Amen.
Thank you, Andrew, for those thoughtful and, how can you put it, motivating words. Each Sunday, we leave time in our service for those among us who are experiencing a joy lifting their spirits up or a sorrow weighing their spirit down to bring that joy or sorrow to the light of this faith community. If you are in the sanctuary this morning and would like to share, when we have finished a brief musical meditation where you can think upon what you'd like to say, you can come up here to the podium and speak into this microphone. I'll be setting it up right there on the stand. And then after that, John will instruct those who are joining us via Zoom this morning how they can participate in matters of the heart. I was just thinking how sometimes trying to do this, bringing in the people who are on Zoom, you know, and connecting with us here, sometimes gets a little awkward or cumbersome, but I think it's so important because what it's doing is saying, okay, that we are not simply bound together because we're in a physical space. We're bound together because we're part of a community. And many of the comments made today in Joys and Sorrows, you know, just remind us how the memories of those who walked before us and the memories of those who walked with us are so important to us and have influenced us so greatly throughout our entire lives. With that in mind, let's bring our time of sharing to a close by listening, if you're here, perhaps singing along if you're on Zoom, to Spirit of Life.
We bring to an end our time of worship together with these words from Jerry Garcia. Remember who we are? We are in reality a group of misfits, crazy people who have voluntarily come together to work this stuff out and do the best we can and try to be as fair as possible with each other. Amen and blessed be.
And now we'll extinguish our chalice, but not the light of truth, the warmth of compassion, the fire of commitment. These we hold in our hearts and take with us into the world to share with those whose lives we touch and whose lives touch ours. We didn't have a Hanukkah miracle here. Apparently the oil was not going to last for 8 days. But okay, now it's time for our closing song. And this is one I think familiar to many of us. It's an early Quaker song based on an American gospel tune, My Life Flows On in Endless Song. And I believe Christine Perry and Isaac Strader will again be performing this piece for us.
It sounds an echo. When tyrants tremble as they hear the bells of freedom ringing, when friends rejoice both far and near, how can I keep from singing to preach?